Welcome back to Music is the Drug, the Cowboy Junkies podcast. You can find us at all the main podcast outlets, so please subscribe, review or like us there. It really does help. Today, with the help of Michael Timmins and Alan Anton and a few rare tracks, we're taking a special look at the album At the End of Paths Taken, which was released 15 years ago this month in April 2007. Just to explain, on these album specials, we'll be looking at the record in the round rather than at specific songs, because we'll be dealing with them in individual episodes as we carry on. Like pretty much every album the band does, it all began with Mike getting out the guitar and the notepad. But how does his writing get manifest itself?
It's hard to know when, you know, it's time to write. The reality of the being in the business and the life sort of dictates it too. You know, you write, then you record, and then you promote, you know, you wait, and then you promote, and then you tour, and, you know, so there is that sort of regular cycle that happens. So as I say, I can't write all the time now, so I need time. So part of that is getting off that the cycle of the previous record, and then a bit of time to relax and figure out, and then a time to go away, and then a lot of time to write. So it kind of goes like that. And I usually know when I want to write. Like, I usually begin to get a feeling. It's this weird bubbling sensation where it's like, I got to get away. I got to get some of these ideas down. So, and that's always happened, which is great. So there's sort of an innate alarm that goes off and says, okay, time to start thinking again about how to process all that's been going on.
You were coming at this one sort of just after there'd been a bit of fuss about the 20th anniversary of the band, and after a covers record, the early 21st century blues. Was that one of the things that sort of made you determined to do something a bit different and approach it differently?
Maybe, you know. I think a big part of it too was, we did early 21st century blues, which was a fun record and easy to do, but the studio record, you know, of relevance before this one was One Soul Now, and I still look upon that record as a low point for me anyways as a writer. And I think I was kind of kicking myself a little bit. Like, I think I'd push that record out a bit, for the first time ever, and I thought, well, it's, you know, we got to get a record out. So I went off and wrote some songs and grabbed some old songs and restructured some songs. You know, it didn't have the same. There's a few songs on that record that I love, that I really love, but as a whole, as a statement, One Soul Now to me was a failure. You know, so I think maybe a part of it was that too. I sort of wanted to erase that feeling and really make a record that had everything, like, you know, well written and also great concept and sounded interesting and sounded cool.
As well as reacting to the previous record, some 20 years and more into their career, the band was also looking at how it could reapproach things, just to avoid things going stale, as Alan explains.
Yeah, I mean, after a while, you think, you know, you don't just want to sit down with the four of us and bang out songs, because it's going to inevitably sound similar no matter what you try to do, you know. So you really do have to bring, you know, other instruments and other ideas into it all, without, like I've said before, like, we don't want to lose our sound. That's what we like about ourselves, is the sound. But at the same time, you do want to keep it interesting and fresh. So you try to find that balance.
I mean, for yourself, obviously you've got a number of writing credits on that. Was that something that you'd been looking at doing before, or?
Not really. It was more in the process of that, doing that record. It was like, you know, normally Mike would have, words and chords played on acoustic guitar mostly, and, vocal melodies worked out for a song, and then we'd flesh it into, you know, a band scenario. But this time he didn't really have that, so he just wanted to, you know, piece together different ideas from different people, including, you know, myself and the composer and whoever else wanted to contribute. So it's just a different approach, I guess, than our usual. And it yielded this kind of interesting sounding record for us, I think.
My little boy on the kitchen floor, my little pet. ask you. Stick man found stick dinosaurs, my little basket.
Yeah, there's a lot of grooves on this record, like My Little Basquiat, and It Doesn't Really Matter Anyway, and Mountain. There might be one or two others on there. Where Al gave me some grooves and some vibes, and I was able to write off of those. So that was really helpful too. And I, you know, we've done that in the past, you know, throughout the band's career, but not regularly enough, you know. And I really needed that. Like, you know, as I say, it gets you kind of get bored with your own writing style. That's one of the reasons why I sort of approached this record from with different tunings, but with Al giving me stuff too, that really helped as well. So that was a big part of it. So all these elements sort of went into making this record. And the other big part of this was that Al had found this guy, Joby Baker out West, who was a fantastic musician and had a great engineer, studio engineer, and brought him into the part of the process as well. So that was great as well. That really opened up a lot of ideas, and he brought a lot of stuff to this record as well. So there's all sorts of different elements sort of began to happen with this record. And that's sort of, you know, anything like this kind of, I find there's it's never one thing, you know. There's, when things change, there's never one thing. It's things come together and you just have to recognize them and go with them.
Yeah, Joby was out here out West in Victoria, and I had met him through somebody locally, and he had a great studio out here and had a great way of working that I really enjoyed. And he's a great drummer and keyboard player and played just about everything. So he could really help out with tracks and ideas and things. And on that record, we just decided, you know, I'll work on stuff with Joby out here out West, and then send it to Mike and see how it goes, how it's going out there, and see what we can combine and work out. So, and we continued that with the Nomad series as well. But yeah, Joby's great in terms of what he brings to the whole studio experience.
I guess Joby Baker had probably a bigger impact as a sideman or however you want to describe it than perhaps anyone had done on the band for quite a long time.
Yeah, definitely. You know, because he's first of all a fantastic musician, but also he was a really good engineer, like a studio guy, like, you know, a producer type, you know. So he brought lots of ideas, and he, you know, when we send him tracks, he sometimes sent them back, you know, with opinions, which was great, and also with, you know, new ideas, like say, well, why don't you know, I know you want this in there, but why don't you take that out and listen to this without that in there? And so there's tons of stuff like that. And, you know, even to the point, you know, there's lots of my vocals on this record sort of in the background. And that's a lot to do with Joby, because I would send him songs sometimes before Margo's vocal was on there. And so he could work on some musical ideas. And then I'd send him finished tracks. And he'd say, well, yeah, that's great, but, you know, this is kind of cool. Add this in there. Well, where I tend to sometimes ignore my vocal, like I don't want to hear myself. So, but, you know, as this outside voice saying, no, that's good, keep that in. That was really, for me, that was really powerful and helpful. But he was hugely instrumental on this record.
And then, of course, there was the strings as well.
Yeah, well, that's true. There's a whole other element too, was I had been hanging out with this guy, Henry Kucharczyk, who was a modern composer, a modern classical composer, like really weird shit. Like, he's just crazy, you know, his sense of harmony and rhythm and what goes with what is, you know, completely outside of my realm and my understanding of music. But I really loved it. I really loved the challenge. And so I approached him with the idea of doing some strings for us, and you know, saying, I want your strings. I don't want, again, like we were talking about, we've talked about in the past with bringing in other musicians, we want their personality. And this is the same thing. I wanted his personality on the strings. So I gave him a few songs, and he came up with these really crazy, really cool, interesting string arrangements, and which again fed into the whole project being different and just being a little bit sideways, you know, and that worked out really well too.
Yeah, that was kind of different for us for sure. We've never taken it to that extent where we just handed over I think 4 or 5 songs to a composer to do pretty much whatever he wants with. And this guy's, you know, he was pretty avant-garde kind of composer. And he came up with a lot of odd stuff for sure that were definitely kind of a head turner for us. And not sure if we liked a lot of it at first, but yeah, there's some really interesting things that he came up with, you know, like on Follower, for instance, Follower 2, the strings on that are something that we've never really done before or anything like that. We didn't see him work. We just gave him songs. And Mike and I went to the recording session with the string section and watched them do it. And that was kind of it. So it went from, you know, here's the songs to come and see us record your songs. So, and that was our experience with it. And then we edited, you know, whatever worked and didn't work after that. Yeah. Like I said, we've never worked that way with someone. So it was very interesting.
It's almost a new beginning in a way, but there seemed a very distinct determination to do something different with this.
Yeah. That was the idea, was let's do something really different on this record, which is why we allowed ourselves to just hand over songs to a crazy avant-garde composer. You know, we never really thought of in those terms before, but it was kind of like, you know, let's see what we can do with an anything goes kind of vibe, you know, while still maintaining obviously the Junkie sound and all that. So yeah, it was, you know, it was interesting working on bits of and pieces of things, because that's mostly what it was. Wasn't really working on entire, you know, songs and ideas all at once. So it was really real piecemeal kind of record, or a really composed kind of record, I would say. But we're really happy with it in the end. I still like that a lot.
I guess the writing process by that stage, it's more complex because obviously you've got children at home and all the stuff that goes with that, taking them here and doing this and doing that. You can't just sit down at home and write. So this is the period where you start to do more and more going away to do your writing.
I usually go away, and I have for a long time. Like whenever I want to write, I start to compartmentalize a bit. Like when early days of Junkies, before I was married and certainly before I had kids, I would write all the time. That's what I do. I'd write on the road, and you know, I had more energy. I had more time. And then, you know, when I got married, there was more time spent with Patty and more attention put to her as opposed to my writing. And so I began to sort of take little writing breaks here and there. And then certainly when I had kids, there was no way I could write at home. So I began to really, really compartmentalize where I would gather ideas, lyrical ideas, and during the year or whenever, just all the time be gathering ideas, writing them down. And then I would try and carve out time to go away and either rent a cottage or borrow somebody's house or whatever, and borrow somebody's, usually in the country because it's quiet and I can get away and just think and write. And so this Past Taken for sure was one of those albums where we had rented, Patty and I had rented this little, really cool little old post office, you know, tiny little building up north in this little beautiful valley, not pretty close to Toronto. So the both of us could get there and back pretty easily. You know, by this point I had 3 kids. And when I went up there, we're talking now, you know, a lot of records in, and I'm trying to figure out how I want to write. I'm sort of bored of just doing, you know, playing the 3 chords I know and writing songs around them. So I decided I was going to approach this song from a completely different, musically from a completely different way. So I submitted, again, we talked earlier about, we've talked about, you know, tricking yourself when it comes to writing. And with this one, I wanted to use different tunings for every single song, and even tunings if I didn't know them, or make them up, just figure out a tuning that could have sounded good and then write. So every one of these songs has is based around a very strange guitar tuning, which made especially Al have to figure out different ways of approaching his parts because it has to harmonically work on the bass. And which sort of gives the whole record a kind of a weird lack of center in a way, like which I really love about it. It's just, I don't know what it is. Just I think because of the harmonically, it's kind of odd, and structurally it's odd because it doesn't necessarily follow. Not all the songs follow sort of your, you know, verse, chorus, bridge approach. And so that was the way I approached it musically.
Writer and critic Cyril Connolly once noted that there is no more sombre enemy of good art than the pram in the hallway. Had he lived long enough to listen to Paths, he'd have had to revise that opinion, because family matters, from children to parents, were the grist to Mark's mill.
Then lyrically too, I you know, from a lyrical point of view, I took a very different approach to it, where I sort of set out with the idea of writing a very specific record conceptually. Usually the concepts come afterwards. I sort of write and then I realize I'm sort of writing about the same thing or the same concept or the same themes. This one, I it was 2005, 2006-ish. And, at this point, I had three young kids at home. Our parents were just beginning. It was suddenly becoming obvious that our parents were aging. You know, it's one of those, you want to have those revelations. My dad was beginning to, show a few little signs of the dementia, which he's now kind of trapped in. So, there's this whole idea of the passing of the torch, or I don't know what whatever cliche you want to use. So I thought of the idea of writing, I just want to write a record about generations, about, and very, very specifically really about males, my son to me, to my father, or the other way around, I guess. And so a lot of these songs are kind of based around that idea, about reflecting on, you now have children and your parents are growing old, and pretty soon, you're the next one up, once they die, you're the next one up. So a lot of, I thought that's my theme. And I just started from scratch and wrote about that. So it has a very, very specific and very focused approach to it. So from a lyrical point of view, that's the way we went about it.
We'll talk about individual songs in different podcasts to come, but just the sort of the arc of it. I mean, Brand New World is a perfect start for, that dawning realization that you're stuck in the middle of it and there's no way out, and it's 4 o'clock in the morning and, oh my God, I'm never going to get to sleep, and how am I going to do this, and how am I going to pay for the shoes, and how am I going to, that is that whole claustrophobic thing in 4 minutes or whatever it is.
Yeah, and that's the, and then with the primal scream at the end of it, and I had to add that. That was my, Margot wanted to do it. I said, no, this is my primal scream. Brand New World, that's again, Brand New World. You think in terms of Brand New World being something shiny and bright, but it's not, this, in this sense it was, and it's sort of this dawning of like, oh my God, I've got these three young children, I'm a musician, and this is 2005, so the music world is completely collapsing again, and as I say, our parents are going down. So it's just this realization that the world moves, and you either move with it or you get crushed, I guess. And so it's just that sort of sets off the journey on this track.
In one of the other ones about rock and roll being trapped in a very standardized, cliched, what rock and roll subject matter is. And, you've got the Rolling Stones, who in the 60s and 70s were still talking about dating girls from high school and all that kind of stuff. Really, you want people to tell you about what life, where you're going, what life is, what it's like. And that's something that, I suppose, beyond the age of about 30, rock and roll doesn't do very much.
Not very much. I mean, I think the great writers do. I mean, to me, that's why I've always, I loved Springsteen for so many years. He took you on that path for sure, that journey. Leonard Cohen on a more poetical and more conceptual way certainly took you on that journey. So there are those who do it and still do it. But yeah, it's unusual. People, I don't know. I think. I don't know what it is. I don't know why writers, and really great writers who've written, many, many great records, sort of lose the thread, and decide they stop writing about where they are and what's happening around them, and kind of revert to sort of cliches and stuff. It's just a weird thing. I guess it's an attitude. It's like, you're trying to, or an image, you're trying to keep an image, and you don't want to let people know you're old, even though they're old. So if they're old, you must be old. So, Yeah, it's weird. It's weird.
And the arc of it is great, coming through to the, you know, through to the last song, My Only Guarantee, which it's kind of a punchline almost.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's taken from that Larkin poem, the idea that, you know, it will fuck you up. It's also from that Grant issue too. There's a Grant literature magazine, English one, that I think I think it was called the title. The theme was Families, They Will Fuck You Up, and that was actually the working title of the album. So yeah, and you know, that was again a fun little weird thing. You know, I got a friend of ours ran a children's choir, so we got them to come in and do the la la las. And I just love the way it came off. It was a perfect sort of dark humor at the end of it all, at the end of this very intense journey.
Keep it coming, I've got your back. Do not fear when I'm on deck. A big lie I've never told. A big story yet to unfold. My only guarantee,
it's always a surprise as well. I don't think anybody swears quite as well as Marco. It's an amazing thing.
she loves swearing on records.
It's one of those records where everything seemed to fall together, because the cover art as well, which I know wasn't necessarily the first choice, but the cover art works perfectly for it.
Yeah, and again, that's my, you know, the hands holding those ropes are my oldest daughter's hands and my mother's hands. So it's, again, you know, years down the line, it's really fantastic to have that image. And yeah, you know, it everything did come together. You know, this to me is one of my favorite albums, like of our repertoire. And it got kind of lost, you know. I think part of it was where we were in the business at that point. We were at the end of a contract with a few people, and they kind of decided they'd spend enough money on the band at that point and decided they didn't want to do any more. So and also where the industry was at that point, you know, streaming hadn't come along. There was the Napster had kind of destroyed a lot of physical sales. iTunes was out, but that was about it. It was just a shitty time for the industry for trying to get a record out there. So it kind of got lost a bit, which is unfortunate, because I think it's one of our best records.
It's a shame, you know, that you talk about it as a lost record, because I think, as you say, it's one of your best records, but I think it's a record that people would get a lot out of.
Well, yeah, I do think there's a lot, like, I mean, I'm very proud lyrically of this record, and I think people would relate a lot to it, you know. People with kids, people with aging parents, people, you know, that's a pretty big part of the population, and people with mature ongoing relationships, you know, that's all in there. So, yeah, there's a lot in there. It's just a matter of people spending the time it's a matter of it connecting with people, you know. There's a lot of weird music in there too. So that sometimes turns people off. So, It takes time. This record is one that you have to sit with, and you have to sort of fall into a little bit. You have to trust it a bit.
Is it one of those records that, you know, there's a vogue for going out and touring or playing a specific album back to front? I mean, is it one of those that might get that sort of treatment at some point?
Maybe. It'd be a very hard one to do, again, because of all the different tunings. I have to relearn all these songs. I have to figure out what tunings I use, first of all. I guess we've played most of these songs live at one point, so we could do it. You know, again, the problem with that is, you know, because it wasn't that successful, people would go, why do I want to go, what? You know, I don't know that record. Why would I want to go see a whole night of it that Enterprise Taken? I'd love to do, you know, a whole series of shows with different albums, but you need to get people to, first of all, you need to convince a promoter that they can get people to come and pay to see it, you know, so. You know, it's a hard one. I don't know if you could do it. We've done it before. You know, we did a couple of nights at in Washington, we did, of course, Trinity, and we also did Black Eyed Man. And then in Athens, we did Demons, the Vic Chestnut record, because that's where he lived. And we also did Lay It Down as well that night, too. So we have done that. And it's fun to do. It's a real challenge. We just did a couple of shows in New York, and we were talking to our manager, and he was saying, you know, maybe we could do four nights here of, you know, do theme nights with, you know, one record one night and maybe something the next night and another record the next, you know, whatever, something like that. So I think the thing is, a place like New York, there's a large enough amount of people that you can maybe get away with it. So it really depends where you do it and how you approach it.
That's it for this episode. We'll be back to our usual single song format next time around as we tackle two songs in one, kind of. If you haven't got it yet, I'll remind you that the band's new album, Songs of the Recollection, featuring covers of songs by the likes of Gram Parsons, Vic Chestnut, Gordon Lightfoot and David Bowie, is out now. You can get it from all the usual outlets or direct from the band at cowboyjunkies.com. The Junkies are back on the road again now, with new tour dates coming all the time, in North America, all over Europe and in Australia and New Zealand too, so you can keep checking the website for news of those shows. If you're a Spotify user, you can follow our growing podcast playlist. All the details of that and everything else is in the show notes. We'll see you next time.